March. And in doing so, I'd like to just review a few things since we skipped a month and went to some things pertaining to the Spring Feast in April. And give some background here. David, of course, was an individual probably more written about in the Bible, even than Christ, and because we don't know that much about Christ in his early years and up until we know about his ministry. But as 1st, 2nd, and Samuel and 1st Chronicles show, and the first two chapters of 1st Kings, a considerable amount of information about David is given to us, plus the fact that he wrote the majority of the Psalms and everything. So we learned quite a bit about him. He's also interesting because of the covenant God made with him, which we're going to get into in the next Bible study. That is quite an interesting covenant, especially when you consider the time it was in his life when God gave it to him. A lot of things on the chronology of David's life help bring more things out, I believe, about him and the lessons we can learn from his life and that it gives to us. Going back, concerning that covenant, the prophecies about David are written starting about 200 years after his death. And of course, the principal ones all talk about that Jesus would inherit the throne of David, and that when he returned and came to the earth, he would set up and be sitting on the throne of David. David was about 16 years of age when he was anointed by Samuel to replace Saul, and eventually, in time, become the king of Israel. But it would be about 14 years before he would come to that point. He would be aged 30. He was about 18 years of age when he killed Goliath, and at a time when he was too young to serve in the army of Israel because he was under 20 years of age. David was not only one who took care of his father's sheep, and as a shepherd, he's called the Shepherd King, but he also learned how to play musical instruments. And we'll see some of that here as we go through these chapters here today. He could play the lyre apparently quite well, L-Y-R-E, which was a stringed type instrument, enough so that it helped to soothe Saul of his depressions and things that he was going through. And for a while he was in Saul's court to do that, and to see if he couldn't help him after especially he turned away from God and rejected God, and God then in turn was rejecting him for that. He had a most interesting relationship with Saul's firstborn son and next in line to be king, and that was Jonathan. And what's interesting there is, a lot of it to me is Jonathan himself. Because we see in 1 Samuel 13, verses 1 through 3, that in the second year of Saul's reign, Jonathan led an army against the Philistines and defeated them. Now, he had to be at least 20 years old to be there serving in that capacity and to be a commander. We find later that in Acts 13 and verse 21 that Saul reigned for 40 years. Well, if 1 Samuel 13 says that in the second year this battle took place, that means he had 38 more years to live, and so did Jonathan, because they were both killed together by the Philistines. That ended their lives. Now, when, as we're going to see here today as we start into 2 Samuel, that David was 30 years old when Saul died. Okay? Now, if that would tell us then that Jonathan had to be probably somewhere around between 20 and 22 years of age in the second year of Saul's reigning in Israel. And that 38, in other words, David wasn't even born yet. And the one that would take Saul's place, the one son we'll read about here today, Ishmael, is 10 years older than David, as we will see. And at the time that this took place, that Jonathan defeated the Philistines in the second year of his father's reign, that David wasn't even born. He was born, it would be 10 years later as far as in relation to the age of Ishmael. So Jonathan would have been somewhere around 58 years old, maybe 58 to 60 years of age when he died. His father then would have been somewhere in his 80s, 80 to 84 years of age. The exact years, we don't know. We do know how long he reigned. We know at what time Jonathan was leading his army, and that was in the second year of his father's reign. And there he would have 38 more years. So if he was, let's say he was 22 years old in the second year of his father's reign, and he's going to live another 38 years. Well, that's 58, isn't it, when he would have died. Quite remarkable, because you find in 1 Samuel chapter 20, and again in 1 Samuel chapter 23, where Jonathan is willing to forsake the crown that would normally go to him to submit to the will of God and give it to David. He knew David had been anointed by Samuel. And shows an awful lot, because, you know, most people lust for that power, and they want that prestige, and they want to have it. And in fact, we'll see a lot of that here as we go through these few chapters here today. Now, I would like to, as you're here at 1 Samuel chapter 1, but I want to go back a couple chapters to pick up a couple thoughts from the last Bible study leading into this one. In chapter 28 of 1 Samuel, Samuel, of course, has rejected God, and he does not get an answer from God through the Urim and Thummim. He has disobeyed God is what it is, and that's how he rejected God. So he went to the witch of Endor, the medium. And, of course, for that, God showed that he was going to lose the battle, and he's going to lose his life. Then in chapter 29, keep in mind at this time, where was David? Well, it told us earlier that for 1 year and 4 months, he was with the Philistines to get away from Saul, who had been chasing him all over the desert of the Dead Sea area, and almost got him the last time. He escaped, though, when the Philistines invaded the land, and so Saul had to withdraw, and that allowed David to get away. So he went to Achish, who was king of Gath, G-A-T-H, and who he had pretended to be crazy in front of years before. So somehow he and Achish got along, and Achish gave him the village of Ziklag, Z-I-K-L-A-G, for him and his 600 warriors and men from Judah and their families to live. And so for 1 year and 4 months, that's where David was. Now, he was telling Achish that I've been attacking the tribe of Judah in the southern part, but he wasn't. He lied. He was actually attacking the Philistines' allies, the Amalekites. And so he would raid them, and it would be closer down toward Gaza, what today is Gaza, and places in the northern Negev of the desert. And he would bring back all this stuff to show it to Achish, you know, what he had taken from the Jews. And, of course, he wasn't. So he was getting in good here with Achish. We come now to the time of the final battle that Saul and Jonathan and the other two brothers of Jonathan are going to be killed. And David comes up in chapter 29 and verse 6 through 9 through there. And he says, I will come to fight with you, Achish. But the lords or the other princes of the Philistines said, we don't trust this guy, and he's not going to come up. Send him home. So Achish here sends him home. Verse 8, and David said to Achish, what have I done? And to this day, what have you found in your servant as long as I have been with you that I may not go and fight against the enemies of the Lord, the king, my king? Now, did he really mean that, or was he just plain lying by calling him my king, my lord, the king, meaning Achish? Well, it's interesting. I believe God saved him from making a very big mistake. Now think about what would have happened if Achish said, yeah, the Lord said you can, the other lords, I'm referring to the kings of the city-states of the Philistines, yeah, they all said, come along, we need you. And he goes up. Now we know how the battle's already been decided, because God told through this medium at Endor to Saul what's going to happen. Well, how would he have been accepted by the Israelites after the battle, when they knew that he and his men were fighting with the Philistines against them? And I thought, you know, now maybe David had something else in mind, that he was going to turn against the Philistines in the battle to give the victory to Israel. That's, I don't know, it doesn't say whether he was going to do that or not, but he certainly hasn't been telling the truth to Achish all along. Because who's on the other side of the lines there if he was with the Philistines? His close friend, Jonathan, who died in the battle. So that's my feeling, and I believe here that God, through circumstances, kept him out of it. Now, chapter 30 is interesting. Achish said, go back to Ziklag with your men. Thanks, but no thanks. On the way back, bad news. The Amalekites, who he had been plundering for the last 1 year and 4 months, they came up, sneak attacked, and they hit Ziklag, burned it to the ground, chapter 30. And they didn't kill the people, they took the people captive. Women, children, apparently, I don't know, sell them into slavery or whatever, that they would be worth something to them. Or make slaves out of them to serve them. Well, it could have been all of the above. So this while this battle is mounting up there at near Mount Gilboa, David and his men really have their work cut out for them, because they have to chase them clear down into the Negev and toward Egypt. And it was because some guy came along who the Egyptians, or who the Amalekites left behind, and he was about to die of thirst. And anyhow, they got from him the information of, turn left, they're down there, to go get him. So, again, it's interesting how God allows events to take place, get David out of the battle, get him away from the scene, and, of course, God blessed him, and they were able to get all of the women and children back and all of that. So, get him out of the scene, and he's completely out of it. Now, let's go to chapter 1 of 2 Samuel. Verse 1, now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag, which was burned down. On the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And so it was that when he came to David, that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. I have good news for you, David. I have good news for you. Now, I want you to notice a few things about how David looked at those who God had set apart at one time and had anointed for a position. So David, verse 3, said to him, where have you come from? And so he said to him, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. Really? And David said to him, how did the matter go? Please tell me, what's happened? He hadn't got the news yet about Saul. Well, dropping down, verse 5, so David said to the young man, who told him, how do you know that Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead? The young man who told him said, as I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa. What do you mean you happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa? You had the Philistines lined up here and the army of Israel lined up, and you just happened to be out for a walk one day and happened to come by chance. The Amalekites were on the Philistines' side. They were allies. The only other possibility would have been if this guy had been captured by the Israelites and somehow got loose. But verse 7, now when he, Saul, looked behind him, he saw me and he called to me, and I answered, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. And he said to me again, please stand over me and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life still remains in me. So I stood over him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm and brought them here to my Lord. Now, in the last chapter 31 of 1 Samuel, the Philistines cut off their heads of Saul and his three sons, the three sons died in battle by arrows or whatever, but Saul fell on his sword. And it says, if you go back there to the last chapter, that his armor bearer also fell on his sword when he saw that his master fell on his sword. Now, Josephus says, interesting, and it may be true, that Saul, in falling on his sword, did not die immediately. And that this guy came along and he killed him and finished him off. The story he's telling to David is not quite true. His evidence, of course, is what? The crown and the bracelet. which was the royal crown and everything. So he was there, but so were the Philistines afterwards. They cut their heads off. And the citizens of Jabesh-Gilead were the ones who took the heads that were put on the wall at Bethshean and buried them, with the proper dignity and all of that. Later would be rewarded by David for doing that. Well, here's a person who had no conscience whatsoever, apparently, of fabricating a story and lying, thinking that it's going to help promote him in some way. Well, verse 11, then David took upon or hold of his own clothes. He tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And yet the men who were with him had been running from Saul for years. And yet they still seemed to have an honor because he was the king. They mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son, for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Well, then, after that, apparently, David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, "I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite." And David said to him, "How was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of his young men and he said, "Go near and execute him." He struck him, obviously, with a sword and killed him. So David said to him, "Your blood is on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" That's how David looked at it. And this won't be the first time. We will see here a couple chapters later. You don't want to lie to David and do something like this and disrespect the office that God had for the individual that sat in it. We'll see one of Saul's sons later who was killed and assassinated, and David handles the assassins in the same manner and way. Remarkable person. One thing you will also note as we go through this here today, how many times David seeks the Lord before he makes a decision to do anything, go into battle, whatever it might be. And when he does not do it, it seems like the worst thing can happen, and it does. But it is interesting. It's a lesson for all of us, as we're going to see, that he always inquires of the Lord. I said always, most of the time. There are exceptions where he didn't. Now notice in 17 and 18, and David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son, and he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher. Now, the book of Jasher is mentioned in one other scripture, and that is in Joshua 10 and in verse 13. The reason I want to take a moment about the book of Jasher is because there is a fraudulent book that's been around for several hundred years claiming to be the book of Jasher. And I had a person bring it to me up in North Carolina quite a number of years ago, probably 10, 12 years ago now, and which was the first time I had heard of it. So I started doing some looking into some encyclopedias and sources that I thought might have something to say about it. The story goes like this. In the 8th century, an English priest, minister, whatever his title was, went to the Holy Land. And after whatever length of time he was there, he comes back to England claiming that he has an Aramaic copy of the book of Jasher. Well, then it becomes lost in England after this guy's gone. And in 1721, it's rediscovered in England. And I'd have to go back and look it up. I wish I'd taken the time to do it now. But anyhow, some group has gotten a hold of it, or what they claim is it, and uses it today and distributes it, apparently. But the portion that I read in it contradicted everything that the book of Genesis has to say about the beginning. And so I knew this person who gave it to me, who left the church thinking that they had more knowledge and understanding than all the rest of us, who were just poor, dumb people, I guess, but did not realize and did not take the time, nor did I think that the individual wanted to take the time to really do some research. Is this a legit book, or is this fraud? and it's fraud. Anytime that you have something that so clearly contradicts the story of the Garden of Eden, the story of leading from the flood up to Abraham and all of that, and a few other things as I can remember, that it was now look, either the book, either Genesis was a lie, or the book of Jasher, as this person was showing me, one of the two, they can't both be right. Well, needless to say, you know which one I chose. but I was surprised how this individual wanted to put so much stock in it. And this person left to go with a group that treats it equal to the Bible, and that it gives you more information and fills in the blanks that are left in the Bible. You know, it's kind of like, reminds you, Paul was talking about to Timothy, itching ears, curiosity, this type of thing that people would have. You know, you have to sit down and look into it and prove it, and not just read it and believe it. Wait a minute, what do you mean the book of Jasher? You know, the book, the only time it's mentioned twice in the Bible, Joshua and David's time. You know how long ago that was? That's 1,000 B.C., 3,000 years ago. And if such a book really did exist and had been preserved down through the years, well, surely we would have it. I mean, not some guy goes to the Middle East in 800 B.C. A.D. and then comes back with it, and then it's lost until somebody finds it in 1721 in England somewhere. So I just mentioned it to you in case you run across it or you hear about it. Do not accept it hook, line, and sinker. Okay? The Song of the Bow is interesting. Two verses out of it. I would read verse 23. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives and in their death. They were not divided. They were swifter than eagles and they were stronger than lions. You notice how positive he is, David is, and yet here's a person, as in the case of Saul, he was out to kill him. Some of the things that he did. Then in verse 26, I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. They had indeed quite a very close and strong relationship there. I don't know, you know, I don't know how you explain it, but there was this. They just took to one another. Particularly, Jonathan was amazed at this young kid. He first met him, I guess, at the time of the killing of Goliath and following of that, and was deeply impressed with this young boy, and that he was senior to by about. Let's see, what did I figure about. Wait a minute, let me think here. When was he was 28, yeah, so he had been 28 years older than David, because he had to be 20 to 22 years of age at the time of the second year of Saul. And David was 30 when Saul died after serving in the kingship for 40 years. So he is also very unusual because of the fact that he was willing to give up becoming king. You know, that's one of the things that upset Saul, was that his son was willing to give the crown to David. The word was around that Samuel had obviously anointed him. Chapter 2. It happened after that David inquired of the Lord, and he will inquire of the Lord many, many times, and every time he does, he comes out on top. It's when he doesn't, and a lesson for us as well. Shall I go up to any of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said to him, go up. David said, where shall I go up? And he said, to Hebron. How did he say this to him? Well, we know from previous chapters, he always looked for a priest who had the ephod. And anytime he wanted to know, because of the stones on the 12 stones on the ephod chest, what God's answer would be. And so he always sought after God. God here, he didn't tell him to go to your home village of Bethlehem. He said, go to Hebron. Go to Hebron. Now, Bethlehem's only, what, 5 miles from Jerusalem, but it would not have been any problem. Why wouldn't it have been a problem at that time? Because the Israelites didn't control Jerusalem. The Jebusites did. And so Jerusalem was not any threat as far as the Israelites coming down from Jerusalem to Bethlehem if he had settled there. But God said, no, I want you in Hebron. And so That's where he settled, because as he came back from Ziklag, what was left of it, and the land of the Philistines, he was inquiring of God, where do I go in the tribal land of Judah? Where do you want me to go? Going on here in verse 6. Well, before we get to verse 6, I'll just tell you what took place there. Once he is in charge in Hebron, he wants to know, who are these people who took care of the bodies of and the heads of Saul and his sons? And they said, well, it was the people of Jabesh-Gilead who took care of them. So he responds to that. David, he wants to certainly grant kindness to those who showed respect and honor. And verse 6, and now may the Lord show kindness and truth to you. I also will pay you this repay you this kindness, because you have done this thing. So David admired people who did these things and who feared God. And he would certainly not let that go without any notice. And here he is. He's just king of the tribe of Judah, not of the nation of Israel. Verse 8, but Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth. But as we will see here shortly, in the book of 1 Chronicles, it's Eshbaal. I think it shows that here in the margin, that his name was actually Eshbaal, E-S-H hyphen Baal, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. Now, this is the temporary capital following Saul's death. Now, remember, where did Saul? He was what? At Ramah, I believe, his village, an area in the tribal land of Benjamin. Now, Abner here is not interested so much in... what he's interested in is Abner, and making sure that he is taken care of. So he's using the fourth son of Saul to... try to set it up so that he will have a good position. So he made him king over Gilead, the territory Gilead's on the eastern side, if I remember right, of the Sea of Galilee, over the Asherites and the Jezreel, over Jezreel, the Valley of Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, and all of Israel. So Ishbosheth, or Ishbaal, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. Only the house of Judah followed David. So he was 10 years older than David, as we're going to see in chapter 5, that David was 30 when he began to reign. The time that David was king in Hebron was 7 years and 6 months. So when he left Hebron, he would have been 37 years old. Another thing or two here about Ishbosheth. If you turn back here to 1 Samuel 14, and verse 49. In verse 49, now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Yishui, Malkeshua, or whatever, three of them. And the names of the two daughters were these, Merab and Michal, who would, of course, be David's first wife. Where's Ishbosheth? He wasn't born at the time that it was listed here, was it? These are the children he had at the time he took the and became the king. Now, in his first year, Ishbosheth must have been born, because he's 40 years old when Saul dies. Now, if you go forward here to 1 Chronicles, it would seem to show that that was the case. 1 Chronicles chapter 8. Now, who wrote Chronicles? Well, when you go to 2 Chronicles 36, the last chapter and the last couple verses, and read those few verses, and then go to the book of Ezra, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, and la-da, you got the same author, that it's Ezra. And this, of course, is the last book of the Bible in the original order. In 1 Chronicles, where am I? Chapter 8 and verse 33. Here we have Ner begot Kish, and Kish begot Saul. Then here are Saul's sons, and notice there are four of them there, starting with Jonathan, ending up with Ishbaal, who is otherwise called Ishbosheth. And it's repeated in chapter 9 and, let's see, verse 939 of 1 Chronicles. So here we see in the Chronicles, which were written, let's see, time of Ezra would have been 400s. the time of that's 600 years later that Chronicles is written. Now, Ezra is very interesting because he leaves the sins of David out of Chronicles and tells only the positive and good things. And it had a lot to do with the division that was taking place in the Jewish community and church or religion. Because the ones at Mount Gerizim in Samaria were claiming that the only thing that we needed to read were the books of the law. You might recall the woman at the well there in Samaria was a product of that too. Well, the reason why is because that Jerusalem and Zion are not mentioned in the books of the law, but only in the prophets and in the writings. And so the writer of Chronicles was showing the Jewish people there that it was to come through the house of David. And it has to be at Mount Zion. We'll see here in a little bit. And not through Mount Gerizim or any of the Samaritans. And yet there were many Jews who were led away during that period of time of Ezra's lifetime to Mount Gerizim to follow, frankly, a false religion and a false god. I would say that because of it becomes that when you're worshiping and following a false religion as they did. Well, anyhow, back to this story. Let's come here to chapter 2 now and continue on. I will just say this for the remainder of chapter 2 from verses 12 through 32 is the story of Israel and Judah during this 7.5 years having civil war between Judah and Israel. During that civil war, you had three commanders and mighty warriors in David's army. They were brothers, Joab, Abishai, and Azazel, I guess is how you would say it. During this time of fighting, Azazel went after Abner, who was commander of the forces of Israel, and followed him and would not back off, and finally came in contact with Abner, and he was killed. And was kind of foolish on his part to do that by himself, take him on by himself. Well, Joab and his other brother Abishai wanted revenge, and they would get it one day, as we will see. But that's what takes place at the remainder of chapter 2. Now we come to chapter 3, verse 1. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, but David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. And that was the case, and that's why we're going to see in part why Abner switches sides. And when he switches sides, that's when he gets the knife. And I mean, we have some of the some very treacherous things that going on here of assassinations, as we're going to see. Chapter 3, verses 2, 3, 4, and 5 is listed David's wives that he had with him in Hebron, which were just two. Now, Michal, remember that Saul took Michal after David had to flee from Jerusalem, or not Jerusalem, but from Ramah to the wilderness. He took Michal, who he had given to David as wife, and gave to this other guy named Pelti, P-E-L-T-I. And so years have gone by now, and so she is in Israel, wherever her home was, with her new husband, if you will. So David had two other wives, one who we're not really familiar with, and then Abigail, who was the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. She bore a son for him. You see his sons and daughters. Now, what you have listed there in those verses are those that he had before he united the country. Later on, once he took Jerusalem, he begins to have more wives and more sons and daughters. There'll be another list, and I'll point it out to you when we get to it, of his later years. This is the years when he was in Hebron. Now, going on, we get here is a story starting in verse 6. Let's just read now. It was so that while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. And Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. So Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner became very angry at the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show loyalty to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hand of David. And you charge me today with fault concerning this woman?" Well, who do you think you are talking to me like that and asking? Do you think he was guilty? Kind of a giveaway, isn't it? When he tries to reverse the blame over to, "There's nothing wrong with me. It's with you even daring to ask such a question to me." So, you know, see how human nature works. Human nature wants to reverse the blame and put it on the other side. Verse 9, "May God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not do for David as the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba, north to south." Look, young man, let me show you what I have the power to do. And verse 11, "He could not answer Abner another word because he feared him." Yes, he knew that Abner had the power to put him on the throne and remove him and give it all over to the other side. So starting in verse 12, that's exactly what Abner then sets out to do. Abner is being very political, looking out for himself. It says, "Then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to David, saying, 'Whose is the land?' Saying also, 'Make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel to you.' And David said, 'Good, I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, and you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face.'" So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife Michal, whom I betrothed to myself for 100 foreskins of the Philistines." It goes back quite a number of years there. And so they did. They took, just reading between the lines here. And so Abner then, as you go drop down the verses, comes to make his peace with David. Verse 21, "Then Abner said to David, 'I will arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires.' So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace." They had an agreement. He cut a deal with David. "I will go get Israel and bring them. I give you back your original wife from Saul's daughter." Well, now this didn't go over too well because Joab and his brother Abishai were not there at Hebron at the time this happened. So at the moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, "Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he sent him away, and he has gone in peace." Then Joab came to the king and said, "What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away and he has already gone? Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you are doing." And so when Joab had gone from David's presence after dressing him down, I guess, he sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Syrah, which David says did not know about it. And so Abner went to talk to him, and as you read on what he did, he stuck a knife in him. When you drop down to the funeral in verse 32, "So they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept." I guess it's kind of hard to feel too sorry for Abner in one sense. He was as much of a murderer and cutthroat as Joab was. But it is interesting how David showed this kind of respect, because he'd made a covenant and agreement with Abner and to bring the nation together. And he looked at what these men had done, his two men, as betraying him. And in verse 38, then the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too harsh for me. The Lord shall repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." Joab would later die. It was Solomon would have him killed. Well, it tells us a little bit also that these two individuals had a certain amount of power and influence that David could not control or handle. And in one sense, David looked to God, but these men were the ones who commanders in the army and must have been respected by enough of the soldiers that he couldn't just immediately remove them for their conduct. So he had to let it go, which he did. Well, as you come to chapter 4, verse 1, "And when Saul's son heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost heart, very discouraged, and all Israel was troubled." Well, he lost heart because he knew it was Abner who had kept the troops together and for him to be on the throne. But in verse 2, now Saul's sons had two men who were captains of the troops. The name of the one was Baana. The name of the other was Rechab, the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, of the children of Benjamin. Now these two, as you read on, decided to assassinate Saul's only remaining son, Ishbaal. And so they did. And in verse 8, "And they brought the head of Ishbaal to David at Hebron, and said to the king, 'Here is the head of Ishbaal, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. And the Lord has avenged my lord the king this day of Saul and his descendants.'" Well, guess what? They thought they were going to get really a great reward for this. They did get a reward. And as you read on, and David said, verse 10, "When someone told me, saying, 'Look, Saul is dead,' thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and I had him executed in Ziklag. The one who thought I would give him a reward for his news. How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house, on his bed? Therefore shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth?" And then he proceeds to have him executed. David did not, put up with treachery, lying. These things especially against people who were in a position that David respected, the position, and that it was to be honored because it was a position that God had given, and in this case, that being king. There's something else about Ishbaal, and it's back here in 1 Samuel 24. The last time that, one of the last times, it is the last time, in fact, that David had a run-in with Saul, or Saul was after him. In chapter 24, now there was one other one, chapter 26, but it's in chapter 24 is what's interesting, a comment here at the end of the chapter, verse 21 and 22. Saul says to David, "Therefore swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house." So David swore to Saul, and Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold that he had there out of the area of Masada. David honored that. That's another reason why he would certainly execute these two assassins who killed the last descendant of a male descendant of Saul. Now, there were female descendants, but not males. This was the last son. And they had assassinated him. Now, David was not going to kill that. You know, they had this thing going on for 7.5 years before the kingdom is united. David could have invaded. He stayed back in Hebron. He never went out after Abner or attacking the rest of Israel. And yet his forces, most of the time, were fighting a defensive battle and winning. And Abner would come up because he's trying to get complete control, but he would lose to Joab. Go back there to read the rest of chapter 2. He was coming out on the short end of it. And Joab was taking quite a number of, not Joab, but Abner was taking high casualties. Well, so David had held back here, and he was not going to go after the descendant of Saul. And that they hear these two guys think that they're going to win some great favor and that they're going to be fully accepted. No, they're going to be executed for what they did. Now we come into chapter 5, and chapter 5, verse 1, "Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, 'Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, "You shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel."'" Now, where did they get that? That tells us that it was common knowledge that they knew that Samuel had anointed him in 1 Samuel 16, verse 1. 1 Samuel 16, verse 1, that Samuel had come down there to Bethlehem, to the house of Jesse, had anointed David, and all the village people they all knew it. And here the people are later. This is about, 14. Is this 21? Yeah, about 21 years later. 21 years later. And they remembered this. Verse 3, "So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron. King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel." So the elders of all the tribes had come. This is a physical anointing, you would call it, because the spiritual anointing was that which Samuel had given in 1 Samuel 16, 21 years earlier, when he was only approximately 16 years of age. Now we see David's age here, verse 4. "He was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah for 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah." So this is, when it comes to the chronology, these are some of the figures that are helpful to us to understand the differences of the ages between Saul, Jonathan, and David. And that makes the story of Jonathan and David even really stand out even more than when you see what a difference in age that was. Now, David does something that nobody had done in verses 6 through 9. Verse 6, "And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites," which were a Canaanite tribe, "the inhabitants of the land, who spoke to David, saying, 'You shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you,' thinking, 'David cannot come in here.'" Look, you think you're tough enough to come in here? This was the fortress of Zion. And no, they're actually despising David here and making fun of him. Look, even the blind and the, what was the other one? The and the lame can keep you out of here. And that's what they're saying to him. So David must have had some inside information somewhere. Because, verse 7, "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion," that is the city of David, and the stronghold of Zion. Now, where was the stronghold of Zion in relation to the Temple Mount? Now, the Israeli archaeologists have found the palace of David in the last, 5-6 years, somewhere back there, between now, going back probably to the year 2000, somewhere in there. I've seen this and read about it more than once. I've even seen in Biblical Archaeology Review some pictures of what they've been able to on Earth. Just down from what is the south wall of the Temple Mount today is where it is located. And that apparently was the stronghold. Now remember, what you have as the Temple Mount has been built up, first by Solomon and then later by, Zerubbabel added to it, and then finally, of course, Herod, in building what we call the Temple Mount today. But if you remove all of that, the little rounded hill of Moriah, where Abraham took Isaac to sacrifice him and was stopped, was not really elevation-wise too much higher than what was the stronghold of Zion. that the Jebusites had. Now, Joshua did take Jerusalem. You'll find it in Joshua 10, I believe. I'd have to look it up to be sure which if I have the right chapter there. And he burned it. But that was the village on the north side. That was not the stronghold of Zion, which the Jebusites controlled for the next 350 years until the time of David. Now, I believe David understood, of course, the significance of the area because of Abraham and Isaac, the sacrifice would have been well known. I think, too, when you read Psalm 110 that David wrote about Melchizedek, he knew where Melchizedek had come from Salem, which later became Jerusalem, and that that was a place, and I think David had more information than we have about it today, that God was setting and putting attention onto. It was a humble place. It was a small village to begin with. It was nothing to, as we would say, write home about. That's the way God begins, with something small, simple, and humble. And when Christ returns, of course, that is where his temple will be built and where he will dwell during the millennium. But anyhow, David, how much of that David knows, I don't know, at this point in his life. But he does take it in verse 8. Now David said, on that day, whoever climbs up by the way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul, he shall be chief and captain. Therefore, they say, the blind and the lame shall not come into this house. Actually, it's kind of clumsy, the translation there. It's David Stern's Jewish New Testament, or Jewish Bible is much better, and others too, more modern translations of that they were actually, you know, making fun of David, and that they, you know, you're wasting your time, David, type thing. You couldn't do it if your hands were tied behind your back or whatever, you know, something like that. Well, for a long time, people have, archaeologists have speculated that what is called Warren's Shaft was the shaft that is being talked about here. I'm not sure if they still believe that that is correct or not. Some sort of a shaft. I had never, when we were there, I had read about it, but I never saw it. That goes down, and of course, the only water source for Jerusalem, or in this case, for the stronghold of Zion, is down at the Pool of Gihon. That comes out of the ground there. So maybe there was some, maybe Warren, I don't know if Warren's shaft would go all the way down there, that there's a shaft that could go down so you didn't expose yourself to get to the water at that time. Again, I'm not sure if they still believe that that might have been the case, but when Warren's shaft, it's named after Warren, who discovered it, found it, they felt that that was this water shaft being talked about here. I'm not sure they still do today, though. Anyhow, David knew of a way to get in to do an inside job on the Jebusites, and that, and Joab was the one who went up the shaft and won the battle. After that, that opens up all kinds of doors because they come together. Hiram, king of Tyre. Apparently, David has quite a reputation, and when the word got out that he's now going to be king of a united Israel, many of these people who had known of David all along probably had admired him. They immediately wanted to make friends and become allies, as Hiram, king of Tyre, was such a person, and he came up there to see him. Now, let's look at verse 13 and 14. Here's the second place where you have the sons and daughters that are all listed. And these are the ones that David had. And David, verse 13, took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he had come from Hebron. Also, more sons and daughters were born to him. And then it lists all their names. Also, you will find this in 1 Chronicles chapter 14 and verses 3 through 7. Now, dropping down here to verse 17. Now, when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David, and David heard of it, and he went down to the stronghold. The Philistines also went and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim, which was the giants. And David inquired of the Lord. Very smart thing to do. Very smart thing to do. They are assembling down here in this valley of the giants where Goliath was killed. Ready, come on out, and let's settle the matter, kind of is what's going on here. So David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord said, go up and you will win, and he did. And you would have thought that would have ended it, but no, the Philistines went and regrouped, decided to come back again. Verse 22, the Philistines went up once again and deployed themselves into the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, again, very a sound thing to do, he said, you shall not go up, circle around behind them and come upon them in front of the mulberry bushes. Look, they're ready for you this time. No frontal assaults. You're not going to win. You go behind them. And the battle's yours. And it was. So he did it twice. He did the right thing. He inquired of the Lord. David was, as the Bible said, a man after God's own heart. And there's one thing missing now that Jerusalem has become the capital, the ark. So in chapter 6, David wants to bring the ark up to Jerusalem. And verse 1 through 4, again, David gathered all the choice men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and he went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, whose name is called by the name the Lord of hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. So they set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab. Now, it's very interesting if you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 6. In 1 Samuel chapter 6, let's take a look at that concerning the ark. Now, all these years, as you're going to see, have gone by. David running for his life, everything going in some ways bad for him. In 1 Samuel 6, the last two verses of the chapter 20-21, and the men of Bet Shemesh said, who is able to stand before this holy Lord God? And to whom shall it go up from us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath and Jearim, saying, the Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up with you. Why? Remember, they captured the ark. Eli died when the news was given to him, the former priest or whatever, judge. And after, what was it, 3 months or whatever it was, it was in this house of the guy, and it was before Dagon. And every morning they'd get up, and Dagon had fallen over that night. And the women were not able to conceive, several other things, and a lot of sickness and disease. And they attributed it to the fact that the Israelites' God, represented in that box, was the reason. So they brought it out. Come get it. We don't want it. So in chapter 7, verse 1, the men of Kirjath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill, and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. And so it was that the ark remained in Kirjath-Jearim a long time. It was there 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. So where are they going to take it? The Philistines give it back. Oh, well, thanks. Now, what do we do with it? There's no temple. The tabernacle at that time probably was at Shiloh. And of course, it then would move around. So David builds a tabernacle in Jerusalem and wants to bring the ark up to put under the tabernacle that's been built and setting in, not temple, but tabernacle, which we would say like it'd be a tent. So it coming up in verse 4, and they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill accompanying, notice it again, it was on a hill accompanying the ark of God, and Ahio went before the ark. Then David and all the house of Israel played music before the Lord on all kinds of instruments, made of fir wood, harps and stringed instruments, on tambourines and sistrums, and on cymbals. They had a pretty good band going here, it looks like, and shows some things, even though in many ways it was what we would call a very undeveloped country at that time. Yet they had musical instruments. They knew how to play them. Apparently were quite good. David would later have a choir of 4,000 on Mount Mount of Olives singing. And we know he played the stringed instruments. In verse 6, and when they came to Nashon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God. He took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the ark of God. And David became angry because of the Lord's outbreak against Uzzah, and he called the name of the place Perez Uzzah to this day. David was afraid of the Lord that day. Of course, the question's always been, why would God kill this innocent man, Uzzah? What did he do to deserve death? Because a lot of people that did deserve death seem to have been able to live, like Joab, maybe, for one, and a number of the other commanders. Well, there is an answer here. Let's go over to 1 Chronicles and take a look here at chapter 13 of 1 Chronicles. Now, as you're turning there, let's keep in mind, David is asking the same question we're asking right now. Why? Why? What could he have possibly done? He is stunned. He's even angry because this is an innocent man who didn't do anything. He was trying to help. He wasn't in any way trying to do something mischievous. But here in chapter 13, 1 Chronicles, in verse 10, we see again, then anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and he struck him because he put his hand to the ark, and he died there before God. Okay, that's again what we just read in Samuel. But now let's turn over to a page or so to chapter 15, and we begin to see, as you're turning over to chapter 15, some time now goes by. David is thinking about this. He's praying about it. He's inquiring, obviously, of the Lord. He is discovering an answer. And chapter 15, verse 2, then David said, No one may carry the ark of God but the Levites, for the Lord has chosen them to carry the ark of God and to minister before him forever. Okay, it's taken him a while to understand and come to that. He's beginning to see the message that God is giving here. Verse 12 through 16. Then he, David, said to them, the Levites, you are the heads of the fathers, houses of the Levites. Sanctify, set yourselves apart, you and your brethren, that you may bring up the ark of the Lord God of Israel to the place I have prepared for it. For because you did not do it the first time, catch that? Where were they back there when they were playing the instruments? Where were they when it was bringing it up on the cart? They weren't there, were they? Now, there's another problem here that comes to light. David did not inquire of the Lord before he went to get it and bring it up, did he? But in the previous chapter, before both battles, he went to inquire of the Lord. Had he inquired of the Lord about bringing it up, the Lord would have told him how it should be done. There wouldn't have been, Uzzah would have never been affected. Uzzah wouldn't have been near it. He wouldn't have even been near it. Let's see. I'm going to finish here this portion. Verse 13, for because you did not do it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us because we, including himself, did not consult him about the proper order. So the priests and the Levites sanctified themselves to bring up the ark of the Lord God of Israel, and the children of the Levites bore the ark of God on their shoulders by its poles, as Moses had commanded according to the word of the Lord. It wouldn't have been on an ox cart. It was never to be on an ox cart. Then David spoke to the leaders of the Levites to appoint their brethren to be the singers, accompanied by instruments of music, stringed instruments, harps, cymbals, by raising the voice with the resounding joy. Notice they were not there the first time. It wasn't that it was wrong for David and his people to be rejoicing with the instruments, but it should have been led by the Levites doing it. And they certainly could participate with them. As you read on, that's what he did. But now as we go back to 2 Samuel chapter 6, And now I'm going to go back to Numbers from there, to Numbers chapter 4, because this also is important. He said, as Moses commanded you to do. Remember that? In Numbers chapter 4 and in verse 5. And when the camp prepares to journey, Aaron and his sons shall come, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the ark of the testimony with it. And then it goes on to show how they're to carry it. And they were to carry it, you know, four men, the box, the poles through the rings, and that's how it was to be done. You don't put it on an ox cart, and you don't touch it. And the mistake was that, you know, the mistake was by both the Levites not being involved the first time and David not inquiring of the Lord. But in the time that he had from the time Uzzah died until 1 Chronicles 15, and I don't remember how many, I'd have to read on to get the exact months that went by. Was it 3 months, I believe, something like that. He had obviously done some inquiring, soul searching, and reading, because the kings are commanded to read the books of the law, were they not, in Deuteronomy 18? And so he was going back and reading, I would assume, and inquiring probably from the prophets like Nathan and who was the other one? I forgot his name now. To get more information about this, so that you can see later, he finally recognizes the mistake that they had made. Now let's finish chapter 6 and we'll quit right there. David with great joy brings it back. And in verse 16, and the ark of the Lord came into the city of David. Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and whirling before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart because his skirt was spread apart, and you could see his legs all the way up to the thighs and everything. But David didn't care. It was of great joy. David did love God. And this was a time of great joy for David and hopefully for all of Israel. In fact, he celebrated here. He, in verse 19, he gave them all a loaf of bread, a piece of meat, cake of raisins. And, you know, that was a mighty nice gesture to do, considering their provisions at that time in their history, that they could do that. Something else that's not mentioned here in this verse that he did, it's found in 1 Chronicles chapter 16. And that is, he had a song that he prepared. And that song is also Psalm 105 in your Bible. And they're exactly the same, 1 Chronicles 16 and Psalm 105, you'll see, are exactly the same. David, a man after God's own heart, wrote some beautiful psalms. They were put to music. Obviously, here we see that they're doing a great deal of celebrating. And then to end it all, he comes to Jerusalem after he has done things for the people. Now he wants to go over and enjoy the celebration with his family. So he comes home, verse 20. He returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, how glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. So David said to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father and all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore, I will play music before the Lord. So music apparently was part of this despising. I will be even more undignified than this and will be humble in my own eyes or my own sight. But as for the maidservants of whom you have spoken, by them I will be held in honor. He was. Therefore, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. And because of her disrespect of David and his office and of his love for God. And I don't know what where she came up with this kind of thinking instead of rejoicing, because all the others did. He had other wives at the same time, by the way, and they didn't feel that way. But somehow she did, and she was just above everybody else. I don't know if she picked that up because of growing up in her father's house or what, always being treated as somebody special. Maybe that was part of it. But David not only was the shepherd king, he was the people's king. And, you know, he gave to the people. He gave to those who showed respect, as we saw with Jabesh-Gilead residents. And with these people, I mean, he opened up to give all that he could generously to them. David always was a generous man. And many, many good traits. He will later on now, this is early in his rulership. He is only 37 years old, turning 38. And he's going to live until 70. And along the way, he's going to make some very serious errors that people seem to remember him more by that than by the other things that he did. Well, anyhow, we will stop there, and we will get into chapter 7 next time, the Davidic covenant and some of the prophecies that stem and come from that.